Was it more on that particular aspect that you wanted to continue with, or do you want to switch to a different?
No, I think that's it. I might switch to one other thing, then we can go down different paths, because they follow a bit the same kind of an orientation, what I call management, and things that are important to managing people's efforts and so forth, and that is safety, which is the other side of the environment, health, and safety. The safety record of Occidental was not very good. I don't say looking at OSHA statistics or industry statistics, they were the worst, but they were not really very good. And it was my sense that if you're going to motivate people, if you demonstrate a concern for their safety and a willingness to invest in whatever, either management resources or capital resources in plants and so forth to make them safer, that they will tend to say, okay, here's a management that is interested in my safety, and you know, a greater respect for the management, because quite frankly, the respect for the management of Occidental was not very high at the time. We had our flirtation with Zoltan Mertzai, who, God bless him, was a great executive at Dow, but did not do well in Occidental, along with two or three others, and they seemed to be people who were interested in, let's say, less interested in the employees than they were perhaps in themselves or other things. But I felt it was would be a good thrust or a good strategy to work on the safety side of the company. And it had its rewards multifold, because we developed a process, if you will, of improvement in safety and injury incident rates and so forth, to the point where we, I think, where we are today, and number two behind DuPont. I don't know if anybody will ever get to DuPont's level, because they are really the leader. But we have a number of Ocean Star facilities in our plants. Our building here is the only building in the U.S. ever to receive an Ocean Star as a work site. And it's truly amazing how motivated people can be to compete for these recognitions as the safest plant. And every single plant in this company whose injury incident rate has gone down, their productivity statistics, their marginal income statistics have gone up in direct proportion to those kinds of things. So I found that to be a very good direction to take, and it's gotten to the point where we don't put less emphasis as management on it, but it's become such a part of our culture that people just do these things as a result of it. So this is kind of the non-business side, but it's critically important to the business of the company and the culture that we have here.
Did you initiate special training programs, or how did you bring about this very successful emphasis on employee safety?
Training programs, yes. Rather than leave the responsibility for safety solely to the plant management, and they had plenty to do then and have a lot more to do now, we put a safety organization in place where people professionally went out and did the typical on-the-job analysis of work issues, of the activity issues and so forth, and developed an what I call ingrained culture of looking at work issues of missing a word here. In other words, what people's work responsibilities are, examining the job, is there a safer way to do it, and looking at all of the safety knowledge existing in industry as to how to make this job or that job more safe. And this safety organization, which has declined in size because we don't need it as much anymore, really developed a direct responsibility to the plant management or the location management, but a functional responsibility to a safety organization that built in what's now popularly called best practices and so forth in safety, and you know, just all of the things that go into focusing employees on working safely, and just worked very well. It's interesting that through these processes, including the environment and worker safety and process safety, that our insurance rates have declined rapidly, workman's compensation, and as well as the process and plant liability and casualty and so forth. That was not the objective, but it could get the benefit in that regard, and Our vice president, or senior vice president, executive vice president of manufacturing, has been asked 3 times to come to a world congress in process safety and process engineering and so forth that is put on by the casualty insurance companies to describe what we do. Another recognition, but that's sort of one of those things that comes with success, I guess. But it's financially rewarding. It is also a very positive employee motivation, and it's worked very well for us. I think it's something that clearly, as we look at these new issues of maximum exposure in chemical process areas and trying to think of the risk management planning that's now inherent in the future of all of our industry, that we'd be way ahead of the curve in this kind of thing. Because if you have to catch up with what is now the requirements that will be imposed on the industry for these kind of things, that would be very difficult to do if you're not equal to or well ahead of the curve, and we are well ahead of the curve in that regard.
It sounds as though you are saying that the changing of industrial practices is not so costly as it is sometimes claimed to be, that in the sense of deterioration of the bottom line for the company.
Well, hopefully I'm putting this in the right perspective here, Jim. It's kind of a case of pay me now or pay me later. You can either incrementally stay ahead of the requirements and stay ahead of the curve, or allow yourself to slip back and then have an event occur that costs you dearly insofar as the requirements imposed on you, as well as whatever the problem may be that develops as a result of it, and put in the capital and do all of the things necessary, or you can maintain it at a very high level. And that's more of a case of pay me now. And let me take a sidetrack here and say that I've been asked several times internally in the company, why are you working toward achieving full compliance with the codes of management practice and responsible care? My answer is simple. I'm going to have to do this. Responsible care is nothing more than a roadmap for what you're going to have to do in the future. And if you want to wait until the future is here and then do it all at one time, well, that's one way. The other is to build in the whole system so that you're spending cheaper dollars today to get to the levels you need to eventually anyway. It's just a roadmap for what the future lays.
And also avoiding a lot of unfavorable publicity.
Oh, amen. 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 So, we've digressed into a lot of other things, but very important. I'm sure you're aware of the things that are happening in the industry as far as the environmental agendas for everywhere from the radicals that we know as Greenpeace to just the regulatory issues that come as a result of being a highly regulated industry. So they all, if everything was done in the strictest interpretation of the things that we hear are going to happen, I'm not sure the industry could survive in some cases, so we need to deal with them in a more proactive and positive way. I generally find myself preaching to the converted, but...
Well, it's good that your own employees in the various plants of Occidental are the converted.
They are. They are the converted.
Well, you've spoken about your innovation in these... company practices that led to and are continuing to comply with responsible care. What kind of innovations have you initiated or encountered in chemistry or chemical engineering in the plant, aside from the environmental regulations and the safety practices?
I need to answer that in a broader way than you might think. Occidental Chemical, OxyChem, in absolute frankness, is not an innovator in either molecules, creating molecules, or in what I will call new processes to either produce new products or in producing existing products in a more efficient way. We have tended to in large part by the processes, licensing processes and so forth, but recognize that those kind of advanced processes are very important to what we do, and therefore at least monitor them consistently as to new processes. There are a couple of areas we have to spend some time in being involved in. One of them is the core of our company, which is electrochemical production, chlorine and caustic. We have had a venture for 15 years now with Eltec Systems in membrane cell development of chloralkali membrane cells. We have four plants around the world that are based on that technology. So we have been, I will call, creative in the technology. We have not done the research on the membranes. The membranes have been, well, basically they're DuPont membrane technology and so forth, but the process technology and the cell development and so forth are patented by Oxitec, this joint venture of ours. We have done some, I'll call it process, continuous process research in our laboratories up in Grand Island on building molecular structures in chemical intermediates, particularly halogenated aromatics, where we aren't creating a new molecule, we're just creating a new process to get to the end molecule. So that has been, if you will, the innovation side of the company, but largely as a commodity chemical producer, licensing in technology. We have never attempted to patent our PVC processes, but we do have a process for converting VCM to PVC that we think would be patentable and licensable. But given the industry as it exists today, this is not something that is such new and remarkable science or earth-shattering science that and the growth in the business is not something that would justify getting to the point of doing that. But we will call it proprietary technology, which everybody has a little bit of, Jim, as you well know. And that, of all things, is the emphasis of our technological efforts, is proprietary process development of licensed-in technology. We think we're pretty good at it. I would largely say that many of our peers feel the same way. But that's been the technology thrust of the company. Just to reach out a little bit here, we are finishing up a multi-product facility in Niagara Falls to produce a lot of different halogenated organics, perchlorobenzaldehyde, perchlorobenzonitrile, a lot of intermediates that go into a lot of products, dyestuffs, agrochemicals, pharmaceuticals, and so forth. The chemistry is different, but we don't end up with a different molecule. Mm-hmm. The process is different by our innovations and so forth. But that's the way we work the what I'll call the technology side of the industry or of our businesses.
Does Occidental Chemical have a substantial research department or force? Or
I assume that you're a chemist.
I am.
Okay. In bench molecular work, we have about 100 people involved in that kind of work at Grand Island in Western New York. Total expenditure is upwards of $20 million. Relatively small as a percent of sales or anything else, and that kind of defines in a pure sense what I've just described as far as the way the company looks at technology. Some of that work, by the way, is supports a very small environmental group that has, it's in the bug bank business of microbial reduction of waste and so forth. So we're of the total $20 million, I would say 15 to 16 of it goes into what you would call research and R&D, the R part of research. And that's pure. When you get into these things, I know the companies tend to throw technical support and those kind of, if you want to make the basket bigger, you add a few things to it. But that's what I would call a pure research function for us. We did, by the way, one of our... take a little aside here. When I was at Olin, we were competing with Hooker for the business of producing perchlorobenzyl trifluoride for Eli Lilly for Treflan, which was one of the most prosperous herbicides for many, many years. And Occidental developed a process that where we lost the business. I was at Olin, and I joined Occidental and found out why they gained the business, because their process was much lower cost. So there is, I guess really I'm getting around to, there are some things that we have invented from a process standpoint. How do we get from toluene to PCBTF? That process is an Occidental process, and it is much lower cost than the other routes. So it's chemical, it's route use of chemistry, not necessarily development of molecules.
Well, chemistry is in the process, not mm-hmm. just in the end product, of course. Would you venture a brief summary of what scientific innovation has come to mean to you as a result of your experiences in the company?
Well, with my experience in the company and in the industry, let's say that as we branch out into biological chemistry, the routes that Monsanto were taking and so forth, I guess if you wanted to extend it out into the real future, whatever you want to call it, future 20, 30 years from now, the processes that we now use to produce several products, let's say, are ones that clearly could be outmoded through biological processes. I'll define them broadly as I can. But we are not taking a direction of that type. I mean, we just are not in a position or have an interest in doing that kind of thing. The advancement of chemistry to new molecules, unless you broaden this into the CPI industries and pharmaceuticals and all that kind of thing. I'm answering the question another way. Somebody asked me, why did I join the chemical industry? Why did I get into chemicals? I believe at the time that I joined the chemical industry, it was a high-tech, high-growth industry. Clearly classified in that regard, let's say 40 years ago. I believe it has matured as an industry, and while innovation is still critical to it, it is a scientific industry. In the world of today, I don't think you could take the total of creativity and science and say that the chemical industry is a leading edge of high-tech, high-growth industries. There are branches of it that are clearly interesting and rapidly growing and so forth, but rather than be new things that people use, they are different ways to get to an end product more than they are a new use for mankind, with the exception of, I'll call, the pharmaceutical industry. Now, if you take chemistry into the pharmaceutical industry, which is certainly appropriate, then that's a whole different world out there, because the development of these, many of these pharmaceuticals is incredibly interesting. We're getting to the point where we will keep people alive through development of pharmaceuticals until we find something that the end of life is unknown. So.
Well, they get to that point in time for us.
I remember thinking once upon a time, I don't know how many years ago, not too many years ago, Jim, given that my father passed away when he was 59 years old, but he fundamentally worked himself to death. I mean, he was one of these farmers and people who working 16 to 18 hours a day was just the way things are. But I said to myself, boy, I hope I live long enough to see the millennium. Hey, I'm expecting to live long beyond that. And I don't know what the life expectancy is today, but it's in the early 80s. And so I think we're... I'm digressing a lot here, but as we find more and more things that the environmentalists and activists say are causing us problems, whether it goes from ozone depletion to persistent toxic and PTBs and POPs and that kind of thing, sooner or later you can continue to find things that impact our life. And as we cure more and more things, then we're going to have to eventually find out that if we eliminate all of this, maybe there's nothing out there that shortens our life. But as we improve the length and quality of life, which has incredibly been beneficial in the last four decades or so, sooner or later you're going to find something out there that is either a part of synthetic development or, in many cases, natural processes that is the real cause. More. and eliminate exposure to them. I know I'm bouncing around here a little bit, but...
Well, one of the topics that SCI is particularly interested in is your view on the future of chemical innovation. Perhaps that's more or less states your view on that.
Well, it does, in one way it does, Jim. I may be off be here, but let me head down the road. If the inputs to chemical processes, if the chemistry that is used, the input to chemical processes, can get to a point where there is zero out that has an impact on human health and the environment through technology, through chemical innovation, I think that's the Holy Grail. Until we reach that time, people will always look at this industry as you make these wonderful things, but you also make these things that bioaccumulate and eventually kill us. If I were to say, again, if there's a Holy Grail out there, it's finding the chemistry and the process capability so that it's a total cycle. Eventually, if you can get that, that's where I think that this industry needs to focus a little bit more than they are now. And I've just noticed that Dow is doing some things with NRDC that is working on reducing excursions to the environment by raw material and process changes so that we don't have end-of-the-pipe controls and so forth. These are the kind of things that I think augur to the future of this industry, to find ways to create in the minds of the public the fact that we do these things, but in so doing, we do not create harmful things along with it. That's a long ways down that road, but that's where I think we would propose to go. Not down to what you call 2 or 3 parts per billion. That's, we can meet those regulations, but those 3 parts per billion, somebody is saying, bioaccumulates and eventually is going to kill us.
You have already identified management agendas that you have articulated since you've come to Occidental with the responsible care or the environmental concerns and the safety concerns. Mm-hmm. Are there other management agendas that have changed or emerged during your tenure that you would like to speak about?
I'd bet the... We could probably spend a lot of the rest of the day talking about what I call the economic investment side of the business, and since we're talking in a scientific area here, I think it's, but it is something that obviously I, of my day job, which is CEO of this company, I increasingly spend time dealing with the economic issues facing the chemical industry, Occidental Chemical, and Occidental Petroleum as a director of the corporation. And that let's start with a statement I made at a meeting with I don't know what it was, or the SCI meeting or the petrochemical industry in Europe, where we were debating what's different in Europe, U.S. industry, European industry, and that is the quarterly results orientation. And as time goes on, increasingly, the value of companies is clearly based on our ability to attract capital to grow our business. And our industry is, industry in total, but certainly our industry is under heavy pressure to justify investment in this industry by shareholders or by any private sources or whatever you wish. We have developed, I think, an incredible capability to build and operate highly efficient facilities, the scale of which increases every time we find a new benchmark, so that what was defined as a segmented industry with very cyclical products like petrochemicals and olefins and far less cyclical products as specialties, whatever you may define them, the industry's ability to identify higher total value added products and less cyclical products has gotten to the point where there are an increasing number of true specialty areas where investments attracted not only in the capital, but in investment in the company. And I think we have to face up to the fact that as our products mature and as this industry becomes more subject to the cycles, economic cycles and investment cycles, that we have to deal with that as an industry. And I'm very much faced with that as a company, and investing and managing the investments we now have. But if we're going to grow as an industry, whether that's to attract research funds or investment funds and capital additions and so forth, we're going to have to attract investment capital to this industry. And it's something that we don't spend a lot of time talking about because we are so obsessed with the environmental issues, and we are, of course, very dedicated to, I think, a scientific discipline. But in the real world that I live in, more of my time is spent dealing with funds that are invested in Occidental. Security analysts want to know why this and that and so forth. Why should we recommend investment in Occidental, and while it's very low in the industry? What is this industry becoming? Is it becoming an industry that can attract capital, that can attract investment? And I think that's something that most everyone is faced with as a company. But you can expand that a little bit and say, is this an industry that can grow by attracting investment capital to it? How we manage that borders all the way from collusion, which is illegal, and not building multiple facilities of that size, to, let's say, a real recognition of what the demand is out there in the marketplace, what the real demand is, what the sustainability of that demand is, what the economic capability to sustain that demand. We have to get much further into that rather than say, oh gee, it looks like there's going to be in 3 years that the supply-demand curve will reach maximum capacity, so let's build a plant. Whatever it may be, and each product that is more value added in this chemical industry, and the more we talk about it and the more visibility it gets, the more rapidly it attracts capital and we continue to add facilities. I think it's just something that as a CEO of a company, as senior leaders in an industry, you've got to think about these things and how you deal with them. Each individual company does it on their own, Jim, but until we learn that we do have to justify short and long-term returns on investments and returns on equity to attract equity and capital, until we really recognize that that's a critically important thing, we're going to continue this. If I've got money in my pocket, I'll go build something, and then we'll worry about what the hell happens after we build it. Something that is very important.
Are these concerns that you're expressing intensified in the industry since you became CEO, or is it a continuation of the concerns that were always underlying the industry?
I think it's intensified, Jim. And I early on said that, and this is true, I think the ability to take a project from concept to operation has shortened significantly, even though the processes are more sophisticated and you know, the building in continuous process operation and all those things seems to be more difficult. You can get a plant up and running that produces incrementally more than its previous predecessor in a relatively short period of time. And so, you know, I think it's a case of, okay, let's, when we decide to build a plant, let's decide whether in real terms that demand is out there or not. We haven't done very good at doing that. Now, the Southeast Asian malaise is something that is either an unfair example of what's happening in the industry today, or it is exactly what I'm talking about. Who ever thought that that growth could continue at double-digit rates in any economic region of the world? Why do we think that was going to happen? It never has in the history of man. So why do we think that? Well, I don't know why we thought it, but we did. And so everybody built a plant to support that demand, and that demand has gone to zero. So, you know, that's a massive.